Our next instructor here at Best Ideas 2018 needs no introduction. With that said, I'd like to share a few words of background. Monish Pabrai is the founder and managing partner of Pabrai Investment Funds, modeled after the original Buffett partnership of the 1950s. Since inception in 1999, with $1 million in assets under management, the Pabrai Funds has grown to over $500 million of assets, largely based on his market-beating performance. Monish is also the founder and chairman of the Dakshana Foundation. The Dakshana Foundation is a philanthropic foundation focused on alleviating poverty, and I'd like to briefly read an excerpt from Dakshana's website. Quote, Dakshana's founders and management have a few core aspects to their vision for Dakshana. These are to be intensely and singularly focused on one or two causes, to focus on causes that do not have a natural funding constituency, to focus on causes that deliver the highest possible ROI measured in terms of improvement in quality of life, to be scalable, and to be self-sustaining where the beneficiary of aid today is a donor of tomorrow. In the coming decades, Warren Buffett's extraordinary success at Berkshire Hathaway will become a rounding error relative to the societal impact of his charitable giving, both financial and intellectual. So too, I think, will be the case with our next instructor that we have joining us in a moment. Monish Pabrai is a generous teacher and role model. Additionally, his work with the Dakshana Foundation, as we're going to hear in a moment, is truly off the charts. A decade ago, when Monish started Dakshana, he estimated that by spending $4,000 per student, his organization could boost each student's lifetime income by an average of $158,000. What has transpired in the year since is truly remarkable, and it's an honor to welcome Monish to Best Ideas 2018. Monish, please proceed.
Thank you, Shai, for that generous introduction, and a pleasure to be at Best Ideas 2018. And I've always been a big fan of the work you and John do, so that's wonderful. I think it's always fun for me to talk about Dakshana, and I'd just like to maybe start with going back to the genesis of why there even is a Dakshana. And it really goes back to being influenced by Warren Buffett, where in reading and studying him, Buffett has highlighted that large inheritances given to our gene pool actually does them a disservice. It actually has a higher probability of a negative impact than any positive impact. And that resonated with me. And Warren also said that, you know, if you're Jesse Owens' son, you shouldn't be allowed to run 100-meter dashes starting at the 60-meter line when everyone else is at the starting blocks. He says it's okay to start at the 10-meter line, but not the 60-meter line. These were strong influences for me. And I realized that, you know, Warren has also talked about how giving money away is far more difficult, especially giving it away effectively is far more difficult than making it. And what my wife and I had decided is that once our net worth went north of 50 million, we'd start giving away 2% a year of our net worth. And 2% at 50 million would give us about $1 million to give away, which is a decent sum to do some meaningful experimentation. And the idea was that as the net worth grew, maybe to 100 million, we'd make it 3%, 150 million, make it 4%. As the years went by and hopefully the net worth kept rising, we'd keep bumping up the percentages. And the idea was that by the time I got towards the end of our lives, we'd, number one, have compounded money at a good rate, which is fun, but also have built up kind of an institution that could do some meaningful work and impact lives. So I was 40 years old when Dakshana was just early 40s, probably like I think 42 or so, when Dakshana was originally conceived. And because we were going to focus, it was pretty clear we were going to focus on education, and we were also initially going to focus on India. This kind of goes back to a quote, give a man a fish and you feed him for a day, teach a man to fish and you feed him for a lifetime. I didn't really have much interest in giving away fish. Both Harina and I had a deep interest in teaching fishing because clearly the ROIs are much better. And given that we were going to be teaching fishing in India while we were based here, and given all the difficulties and corruption and distance, I just assumed that we might spin our wheels for maybe at least 10 years, which means, you know, we would have kept giving a million or more a year and we wouldn't have seen any output. And I just viewed that as part of the tuition bill to learn how to do this properly. And so when I started in my early 40s, the idea was that by the time I got to my early 50s, we would have kind of sort of figured out how to actually make it work. And on a number of fronts, we got extremely lucky. And I remember in 2006, in the fall of 2006 in Irvine, I was reading an article in Business Week. And the article was talking about a guy in Bihar in India, which is one of the most underdeveloped backward states in India, very high population, very low quality of life. This guy in Bihar, Anand Kumar, was identifying 30, 18-year-olds a year who were really smart but very poor. And then he took them under his wing for about 8 or 9 months. And then after 8 or 9 months, they took the IIT entrance exam. And he had between a 80 to 100% success rate in getting these kids into IIT. And the Indian Institute of Technology, where there's about a dozen or more campuses now, is the toughest set of engineering schools to get into in the world. And the admission criteria is very objective. It is simply based on a couple of tests. These are pretty intense tests on physics, chemistry, mathematics, and logical reasoning. And about a million kids take this test every year. And there's about 12,000 or so seats across all the different campuses. So the acceptance rate is just 1.2%, which is a fraction of the acceptance rate of even places like Stanford or Harvard. It's a very difficult exam. It requires a lot of prep. And so what Anand Kumar was doing is he was taking these kids in, providing free room and board. His mother would cook for them. And then he and a few other teachers would train these kids. And once you enter the IITs, it's difficult to get in, but once you enter the IITs, it's a very heavily subsidized set of institutes. The cost of a four-year IIT engineering degree would be about $7,000 or so, maybe around $1,500 or $1,700 a year. Even that $7,000, it's very easy to get either grants or bank loans, especially if you have needs. So once you get in, it's almost 100% that you'll be able to go through the degree program and such, regardless of whether you even have a penny to your name. And of course, once you go through the IITs, then you pretty much get connected to the global economy and Microsoft's recruiting from there and Cisco and Google, and IIT grads are sought out the world over. So pretty much once you enter the IIT, you become a great credit risk, first of all. And then secondly, you have a wide range of employment choices in India and around the world. It's pretty much a very simple zero to hero if you can get in. Now, of course, getting in is really hard. So what was really surprising to me when I read about Anand Kumar was that, you know, he's a teacher. He provides private tutoring to kids in the slums. And then he was taking a small portion of what was left over from that, or maybe a large portion of what was left over from his paid teaching activities. He used that to fund this 30-student program. And he was spending about $800 per kid over that 8 or 9 month period. When I read the article and I saw the success rate and I saw that $800, I said, wow, you know, if you spend $800 and get a really poor kid into IIT, the ROI on that investment is off the charts. Because the first thing that happens is that by spending the 800, it unlocks something close to a $30,000 or $40,000 subsidy by the Indian government to pay for their education. And then subsequent to that, it opens up a wide range of career opportunities. So I contacted Anand. I was able to get his email address. And I said, listen, I'm really excited about the work you're doing. And we'd be very excited to fund you. and to see if you could scale your program. And Anand was kind of somewhat curt on email. He said, thanks for the appreciation, but you know, we don't take any donations or anything, and all the best. I again nudged him after a few weeks and I got a similar response. So then I said, you know, let's go meet the guy in person. So I told him, listen, I'm coming to Patna in Bihar in like February of 2007. Would he be willing to meet with me, and could I meet the kids and so on? And of course, he was very gracious and he said, you're most welcome and such. So when I met him, I thought maybe I'd use my persona to convince him that scaling was in the best interest of humanity. But it was very clear he wasn't interested in changing anything about the way he was running things or expanding things or taking money from others. So then I asked him if he would have any objections if I cloned his model. You know, obviously in investing and even before that in my entrepreneurial pursuits, I had realized that cloning was a very powerful mental model. And of course, Anand said, I'd be very supportive if you want to scale this model. And I try to provide you all the help you wanted. I'm all for it if you want to take this model and run with it. So that's what we decided to do. I said, okay, since I can't get him to do anything, why don't we just try to see if we can do it on our own. But of course, you know, I'm a guy who goes to work in shorts in California and absolutely no presence or contacts or anything in India. So I was trying to figure out, you know, how am I going to kind of make this happen? And one of the things that I was lucky about is that I had a lot of experience in early stage businesses and startups and so on. Starting a for-profit or non-profit isn't that much difference. I contacted some of my friends in the US who were IIT grads and such. And I said, listen, I'm looking for someone in India who can maybe be a consultant to me, who can help me crystallize this model and starting to put these pieces together. So one of my friends was from IIT Madras. He said, listen, there's an alum message board. I can put a posting on the message board. Why don't you write up something? And I did that. And basically what ended up happening is that I got a number of responses, but one of the responses was from this older retired gentleman who was IIT Madras grad in his 60s. And he said, listen, your project sounds interesting. I'm retired and I've got time available. He lived in Bangalore. Tell me what you'd like me to do, and I'm willing to give this a try. I basically brought him on as a consultant where he would be getting paid something like $100 for every day that he put in this effort. And of course, he'd get paid partial day. I worked out some hourly rate and such for him. And he didn't really care so much about that. He just said, sounds fair, and let's get going. So once we had a general understanding, I basically told him, listen, the one piece of the equation that we don't know, which is kind of a black box that I haven't yet cracked, is how do I find poor kids who are very bright and find them in some significant quantities? Of course, what Anand Kumar had been doing for so many years is he had built a kind of a brand and a reputation. So every year when he announced his selection test for this batch of 30, a few thousand kids would show up to take the test. And then from that, he'd pick his 30. So in our case, with Dakshina, we were unknown. We couldn't quite clone that. And I was trying to figure out how we go about doing that. And anyway, Ramesh started meeting people. I asked him to go meet the coaching institute to provide IIT coaching for a fee. And one thing led to another. There's a school system called Jawahar Navodaya Vidyalaya, JNV, which is a school system that I'd never heard of, and most Indians I would talk to have never heard of. But it's quite a remarkable school system that was set up by the Indian government. There's 600 of these schools. They're boarding schools. They're magnet schools. They're in every district, which is like a county in every district in India. And these schools are from 6th grade to 12th grade. And the admission process is based on an IQ test, language independent IQ test in 5th grade. And about 2 million kids a year take this IQ test, and about 40,000 of them get admitted into the school. So it has about a 2% admit rate. So when I saw the nature of these schools and that they were a magnet program and that they were pulling kids from the absolute bottom of society, and the Indian government was pretty much paying for everything, so it was a fully paid system, we went and spoke to the folks who ran the school system in Delhi and explained to them what we were trying to do, and they were receptive. One thing led to another. We got a MOU done, and we basically said that out of these 40,000 kids in every grade, we would pick like the top 4,000 based on test results and invite them to take the Dakshina selection test. And from the Dakshina selection test, we would pick about 400 kids, and we put them in maybe, you know, 8 or 9 schools around the country. And then those 400 kids, we would prep for the IIT entrance exam for a couple of years. Of course, we were taking 400 kids out of an original pool of 2 million. So with that level of filtering, obviously, we were going to have some really smart kids. And the negative in all of this is that these government schools do take in really smart kids, but after that, the execution at the school level and at the teacher level can be hit or miss. We've sometimes noticed that the height of the kids is really short, which means there's not proper nutrition. And we've also noticed sometimes that the teachers, et cetera, aren't the best and so on. So the schools do take in great talent, but in the 5 or 6 years before we get to them, I think large swaths of that talent does not get up to its potential. But even then, you know, because we are doing such heavy filtering, once we took these 400 kids, so the first time we did this, we had a success rate approximately 15 or 20% of these kids going to IIT, and we had a lot of issues and problems with our coaching. But I've always felt in businesses and in startups that you just want to make tomorrow better than today. And once we could identify the results, because the results are very precise and metric driven, then we could also look at why we were getting the results we were getting. And then from that point on, all I cared about was blocking and tackling and kind of improving the results. So now, Dakshina, if you fast forward 10 years, we are taking in somewhere around about 1,100 kids a year. And our success rates have gone up quite a bit. Last year, we were in the mid 80s. 80, 85% of the kids going to IIT. And we've also expanded to training doctors as well as engineers. And even there, the success rate is pretty similar. What we also did a few years back is we bought a 109-acre campus of our own. And we run our program in the government school systems. And we also run the program on our own campus. And what we found in the government is that many times they were slow to act, slow to scale. And so now with our own campus, we're able to scale up quite quickly. And one of the things about the nonprofit world is that, you know, in the for-profit world, when you're running a business, if you do not deliver value to your customers, what's going to happen is that the business is not going to produce a profit, and eventually it's going to cease to exist. So there's a feedback loop. There's a very tight feedback loop in the for-profit world, which makes sure that the only businesses that have a kind of an enduring quality to them are ones that truly deliver for the customers and have all the pieces set up so that they have great employees and great customers and great financials and are able to make it all work. In the nonprofit world, we don't have this feedback loop. So, you know, I had mentioned that once we cross 50 million, we give away 2%. So as long as my net worth stays over 50 million, I could keep giving the 2% regardless of outcomes, and which is not the case in the for-profit world. So in the nonprofit world, the lack of a feedback loop is very problematic because it means that you cannot course correct, and every business does well because they listen to the feedback and they continuously course correct. What I did is, using one of Charlie Munger's mental models of inversion, we made a decision that we would only focus on causes where there was a feedback loop. So there are many, many causes in the nonprofit world that are very worthwhile, but measurements are either difficult or impossible. And there's a sliver of causes where measurements are actually possible. So the first thing we did is we said, well, if something cannot be measured, we're not going to go into that endeavor, even though on the surface it might sound good or it sounds like we might be doing good, but because we can't get tangible measurements, we wouldn't be able to know whether we were doing a good job or what we need to do to improve and so on and so forth. So what I liked about the Anand Kumar Super 30 model with Dakshina adopted is there were two metrics available every year. The first metric was how much money was spent on every child or every kid to get them trained for the IIT exam. That's a very precise number. And the second metric was, what were the results? How many kids took the test and how many were admitted to the IITs? And the thing about the second number, the second metric about the admission rate or the acceptance rate, is that we had no control over that. We have control over how much we spend per child, but we have no control over outcomes. Someone else kind of does the scorecard on that. And so it's not subject to corruption or management fudging things or any of that, because it's not like my management team can tell me, oh, you know, we did a great job this year and kind of wave their hands. I always just look at the test results and the acceptance rates, and that tells me pretty much all I need to know. So the thing with Dakshina is that when we first started, we had a certain amount we were spending per kid. And the second metric was, what was our conversion rate? So like I mentioned, in the first few years, we were spending around $3,000-$4,000 per kid, and the conversions were 15-20%. It was very low. And now we're spending around $2,000 per kid, and the conversion rates are north of 80%. And we'll see if we can reduce that $2,000 further. Even if it doesn't go down, the conversion rate, the acceptance rate stays up there, the ROIs are really high. The second thing that's happened is that, of course, in the last 10 years, thankfully, with the power of compounding, the net worth's gone up. And so now, I think for my family, the annual giving is north of $6 million a year, when it used to be about $1 million a year. And we've had some folks like Prem Watsa at Fairfax who've committed to $1 million a year. And we've got a number of other donors, and also some of our kids who graduated have also started contributing. So Dakshina is on a very robust financial footing at this point, which is great. We spent $10 million on our campus and we've paid that off. Last week, I made the last payment on that asset, which is great. And one of the things about the model we have with training these kids for IIT and spending, let's say, $2,000 or $2,500 per kid is that once we are doing something like 2,000 or 3,000 kids a year being trained, we're not there yet, but we'll get there. And once we are spending kind of in the 4 or 5 million a year range, the system may not be able to absorb more than that. And so we are now getting to the point where our resources for the first time in 2017 and beyond are thankfully exceeding what this program can absorb. So the first thing we're doing is, you know, we're taking in about 1,100 kids a year, and we're going to be working in the next 3-4 years to increase that to about 3,000 so that we max out the program. And then we'll have to, again, go back to the drawing board and figure out what's the next program. And of course, we lucked out big time because the Dakshina program right now has very high ROIs. And it's perfectly fine if we have to drop our bar, if you will, a little bit. But I think these pieces that have worked well for Dakshina have been the measurements and metrics have been really important. We have never, ever hired a single person from the nonprofit world. So we have a fairly large team in India now. None of them have come from the nonprofit world, and that is by design. I did not want to get people from, because I think the nonprofit world has a lot of bad habits because they're used to this, you know, continuous drip coming from some donor, where most donors aren't so focused on the measurements. And so that leads to a lot of inefficiencies in the way they almost run like government departments, if you will. I never wanted that for Dakshina. So we've always taken people who basically had no experience with that sort of a culture. So we never had to teach them to unlearn stuff. So the team is really good. I've been very lucky. We have a fantastic CEO, Colonel Ram Sharma, and then he's brought in a great team under him. It's worked out vastly better than I would have thought in terms of when I started and where we are today. Also, my life and my family's life would be far less interesting and far less exciting if there weren't a Dakshina. Some of the best days of the year for me are when I'm either visiting these scholar homes in the middle of nowhere in India, or I'm meeting with the kids in the classrooms and such. Those experiences have just been, they're priceless. They've just been amazing. And I think that I've been very lucky that all of these pieces came together. There was a Anand Kumar, there was a Super 30, we found a great CEO, we found the government of India was willing to cooperate, and we focused on the metrics and worked on the improvement. So all the pieces came together really well. And so we'll see what lies in store in the decades ahead, but it's a fun journey.
I understand that together with Guy Speer, you enjoyed a private lunch and conversation with Warren Buffett. I'd love to learn how the experience impacted your thoughts on charity.
I think the objective I had in bidding for the Buffett lunch was simply to thank him. I didn't really have any other expectation. At the time in 2007, when we were bidding for the lunch, most of my net worth had been generated because of Warren Buffett's intellectual property, if you will, which he's, freely shared with the planet. And I just felt that I owed him a huge debt. And he was willing to take a bribe and sit down for a meal. So, and he was living when I was living. And so I said, why don't we pay the bribe? The bribe is going to a good place, and see if we can win the lunch. And I just want to be able to look him in the eye and just thank him from the bottom of my heart. So that was the primary driver for the lunch. Of course, what I learned at the lunch is that and subsequently is that Warren is very focused on making sure that the folks who win these lunch auctions, he realizes that it's a big deal for the people who win these auctions, and for many of them, the amounts are large as well. He wants to make sure that at the end of the lunch, they feel like they got a bargain. So he tries really hard to deliver incredible amounts of value. And so, for example, when he showed up at our lunch, and I went with my wife and kids, and Guy came with his wife Lori. The first thing he said to us is, "Listen, I got nothing going on all afternoon, and when you guys get sick and tired of me, just let me know, and I'll leave. But I don't have a specific schedule or particular time. So the lunch, basically, what Warren was saying." There was no time limit on the lunch. And the second is what would happen is that whenever me or someone else would ask a question, he always tried to convert these questions, even though sometimes they were innocuous questions, he tried to convert them into learning opportunities and such. So the thing with both Warren and Charlie is that they've been very open, and almost everything about them is in the public domain. And so if you want to learn, what Warren Buffett has to teach or what Charlie Munger has to teach, you don't need to meet them or have lunches with them, any of that. Read the biographies or the Berkshire letters or, Poor Charlie's Almanac and those sorts of things, and the transcripts of the annual meetings and so on. And you will learn an incredible amount. And so, but what the lunch did for me is it helped me calibrate some of the things that were really important to Warren. We know he cares about a whole bunch of different things, but it helped me calibrate what aspects were more important than others. And before he came to the lunch, I had sent him the first Dakshina annual report. We had just published our first report in 2007. he had read every word of that report, and he was, you know, from memory, quoting things from certain pages. He'd say, oh yeah, on page 7, you had this and that and all of that, which was really surprising for me because I had no idea what was on page 7, but he did. And subsequent to that, you know, I send Warren the annual report for Dakshina every year. And he, I think most years, he finds the time to read it and sometimes writes notes back and so on. So what the lunch did is it helped me calibrate what were the things that were really important to Warren. And one of the things that's one of the most important mental models for Warren Buffett is the mental model of an inner scorecard. And, you know, this is covered in Alice Schroeder's biography. Is, you know, you can live your life with an outer scorecard, which is the way the world sees you, or an inner scorecard, which is you measure yourself based on internal yardsticks, not external yardsticks. And that is very fundamental to who Warren Buffett is. He uses internal yardsticks. He also does not care about whether a particular action he's taking is acceptable to society or not. He makes a decision on acceptability based on an inner scorecard. So these were things I could read about in Alice's book, but I think in the interaction, it became very clear that that was important. We spent quite a bit of time talking about philanthropy and you know, giving back and all of that, and a lot of great thoughts that he shared on that front. But I would again stress that a careful study of Warren and Charlie, you're not going to be missing much whether you get to sit down for a meal or not.
I'd love to ask, what would you suggest are appropriate next steps for anybody who's curious to learn more about Dakshina or perhaps inspired to get involved?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, you know, we have a website, dakshina.org, dakshana.org. And, you know, please feel free to browse the website and such. There's a lot of data on it. We have profiles on a lot of our scholars on it. The other thing you can do is we have all our annual reports on the website. Warren has told me that the Dakshina annual reports are the best annual reports he's ever seen from a nonprofit, which was you know, made me feel really good when he mentioned that. And of course, you know, one of the reasons he probably feels that way is I took a lot of cues from the Berkshire annual report. So we don't have pictures in our annual report. It's a black and white report, and it's a letter from me to the constituents of Dakshina. And we spend a lot of time on the metrics, and I think he probably appreciates that. So and the other thing that, you know, which is also something I learned from Warren, is that if you've got bad news and good news, put the bad news up front. And one of the things that you know, which is a Berkshire culture, is that Warren always brings up the bad news first, because if you bring up the bad news first, you have a good chance to learn from it and improve yourself. If you sweep stuff under the rug, one of the problems is you yourself never learn from it. So what I've always tried to do at Dakshina is that we've made a zillion mistakes. We made, and we'll continue making the mistakes. We spend a lot of time highlighting those mistakes in the annual reports. You know, just to show you how dumb we are. And so I think if people are interested, you know, I think the annual reports are a good place to go. And there's a few different ways to get involved. I think that it's easier if you're in India, if you want to, you know, give time and such. We've got a number of things we can do. You know, we've had people serve as mentors and different things. And now our alums do a lot of that. And certainly you could you could become a supporter with financial contributions and such. It's another way to get involved. But I think that, you know, like I said, to me, the best thing would be if people just studied it, and then whether or not they support us, but if it has some impact on their thinking on the subject, then I think that's all I can hope for, and I think that'd be a wonderful outcome.
I'd love to ask the question of trust but verify. Anyone who is trying to get a firsthand due diligence perspective, where should they begin and how should they proceed?
Yeah, I mean, I think that at Dakshina, it's an open book, so it's easy to meet the kids, it's easy to talk to them, it's easy to meet the alums, you know, because they're now on their own, and get perspectives from them. So I think clearly you can get a lot of data from us on our website and such. But I think you could also kick the tires by meeting the alums. And I think we have a number of alums now who are in the US. You know, they're working for places like Microsoft and Google and such. And some of them are going to grad school, they're doing PhDs and so on. So we have now our alums are all over the world. So it's relatively easy, no matter what your geography is, to actually even have you know, phone conversations or whatever with some of these folks, and we encourage that. You know, in fact, I always try to get data from the alums on, you know, how can we do better, or what was the problem when you went through the program, and that sort of thing.
In terms of on-location site visits, do you have any perspective if that's welcomed or if that needs to be coordinated somehow?
Yeah, we welcome that. Obviously, we need to coordinate it because the kids are obviously on an intense program for 2 years, but they like the diversion from you know, taking a few hours off from their intense studies. We've had, you know, Prem Watts has visited a couple of times with his family, and we've had a number of other luminaries interact with them. So there's a number of ways to interact with the scholars. One is to visit one of the 8 locations where we run our program. That's one way to do it. Another way is to visit the IITs where we have all our alums, or the NITs, the National Institute of Technology. So our alums are in all these institutes. That's another place, and these are in places like Mumbai and Delhi and Chennai and so on. And then also another way to interact is to interact with them when they're in the workforce, and in that case, you know, they're going to grad school. So we've got folks in Michigan and California and New York and so on, and of course all over the place in India and Singapore and other places. So there's a number of different ways the interaction can take place, and one of my favorite ways to interact is to visit the scholar homes, and those are complicated because, you know, these are in very remote geographies, and it takes a lot of coordination to make it happen. But I've done a number of trips. Usually I've tried to do one trip a year when I focus on meeting scholars in their homes. Been a little busy in the last 2-3 years, so that's hasn't been as much of a priority, but I'm hoping to get back into it. But those have been some of the best trips and the best days that I've spent. And I think that's when we truly can see the impact of the program, when we go deep into some of these villages in India, and we are actually able to see how the families are living. And in many circumstances, it's very desolate conditions. And how quickly that gets reset.
And as a final question, I'd love to ask what you would suggest are the right 10-year goals, both from your side and for anyone who is a contributor.
Well, I think on our end, one of the things we want to do is we want to make sure that we have a high input-output ratio. And I think the simple thing is that if we are spending $2,000 or $3,000 per kid, and we are getting these 70-80% type outcomes, because even the other 20-30% go to very good schools, that engine is working. Obviously, we have to, the third piece is to make sure that we're picking up the right demographic, where they wouldn't have an option if we weren't in the picture. So those are the two or three things that matter that we're focused on. But I think that if I look 10 years out, it's a bit scary, because we'll see how the compounding goes. But the good news with compounding is the numbers start getting large. And as the numbers start getting large, you just need to put more infrastructure, and you need to be willing to take lower returns as you scale up. And so those are all good problems to get to when we get to those. I think that we may get to those types of scenarios in the next 2-3 years. But if I go 10 years forward, and just simple math is, let's say I assume a 15% increase in net worth every year, for example, which means we'd go through two doubles. It may be faster than that, because I get fees on other people's money. But just what it would do is that the 160 plus million would get to something like 650 million or something, or 640 million in 10 years. And then if we are at that point giving away, I don't know, 5 or 6%, that's north of 30 million. And it's not, I mean, as I think about it today, I don't know how we would spend even 4 million or 5 million today, let alone 30 million. So we'll have to, in the next few years, figure out. And one of the things about the difference in the for-profit and non-profit world is that in the non-profit world, one should be very willing to swing for the fences. And one should be very willing to take big losses. So if you want to change human trajectory, you have to go high risk, high return. Whereas in value investing, we try to go low risk, high return. So if we have those types of resources at our disposal, a $30 million a year budget or something, Dakshina will be very willing to swing for the fences, knowing we might miss a lot, but we will definitely take some swings. And to some extent, even people like the Gates Foundation does the same thing, where they're trying to make significant trajectory changes with vaccines and those sorts of things. So we'll be looking for kind of fulcrum type things, like, where can I get the most leverage, and is it hard? And if it's hard, that's fine. That's not going to dissuade us. In fact, the harder the better. What we're really interested in is, can I get huge bang for the buck, and can we scale this? So I think that's kind of where I hope 10 years from now we do more than the 15%. I hope 10 years from now Dakshina has, let's say, $100 million a year budget. I don't know if that'll happen or not, but I hope that happens. And I hope we are swinging hard at the fences, and we may be missing a lot, but we'll also hit sometimes.
On that note, Monish, thank you so much for sharing your time with us and having such a wonderfully candid conversation together. I hope that participants will take the time to visit dakshina.org and learn more. Monish, it's an honor to have you here. Thank you for your time.
Always a pleasure, Shai. Thank you.